Today as they were when the amendment was decreed. First, our doctrine of political freedom is not a visionary abstraction. It is a belief which is based in long and bitter experience, which is thought out by shrewd intelligence. It is the sober conviction that in a society pledged to self-government, it is never true that in the long run, the security of the nation is endangered by the freedom of the people. Whatever may be the immediate gains and losses, the dangers to our safety arising from political suppression are always greater than the dangers to that safety arising from political freedom. Suppression is always foolish. Freedom is always wise. That is the faith, the experimental faith, by which we Americans have undertaken to live. If we, the citizens of today, cannot shake ourselves free from the hysteria which blinds us to that faith, there is little hope for peace and security, either at home or abroad. Second, the rewriting of the First Amendment, which authorizes the legislature to balance security against freedom denies not merely some minor phase of the amendment, but its essential purpose and meaning. Whenever in our Western civilization inquisitors have sought to justify their acts of suppression, they have given plausibility to their claims only by appealing to the necessity of guarding the public safety. It is therefore that appeal which the First Amendment intended and intends to outlaw. Speaking to the legislature, it says, "When times of danger come upon the nation, you will be strongly tempted and urged by popular pressures to resort to practices of suppression, such as those allowed by societies unlike our own, in which men do not govern themselves. You are hereby forbidden to do so. This nation of ours intends to be free. Congress shall make no law abridging our political freedom." The second objection which must be met by one who asserts the unconditional political freedom of the people rests upon the well-known fact that there are countless human situations in which, under the Constitution, this or that kind of speaking may be forbidden by legislative action. Some of these cases have been listed by the courts in vague and varying ways. Thus, libels, blasphemies, attacks upon public morals or private reputation have been held punishable. So too, we are told that counseling a murder may be a criminal act, or falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. Offensive or provocative speech has been denied legislative immunity. Contempt of court shown by the use of speech or by a refusal to speak may give basis for prosecution. Utterances which cause a riot or which incite to it may be subject to the same legal condemnation. And this listing of legitimate legislative abridgments of speech could be continued indefinitely. Their number is legion. Now, in view of these undoubted facts, the objection which we must try to meet can be simply stated. In all these cases, it says, inasmuch as speaking is abridged, exceptions are made to the First Amendment. The amendment is thus shown to be, in general, open to exceptions. And from this it follows that there is no reason why a legislature which has authority to guard the public safety should be debarred from making another exception when faced by the threat of national danger. But the validity of that argument rests upon the assumed major premise that whenever in any way limits are set to the speaking of an individual, an exception is made to the First Amendment. But that premise is clearly false. It could be justified only if it were shown that the amendment intends to forbid every form of governmental control over the act of speaking. Is that its intention? Nothing could be further from the truth. May I draw an example from our own present activities in this room? You and I are here talking within limits defined by the Senate. I am allowed to speak only because you have invited me to do so. And just now, everyone else is denied that privilege. But further, you have assigned me a topic to which my remarks must be relevant. Your schedule, too, acting with generosity, fixes a time within which my remarks must be made. In a word, my speaking, though free in the First Amendment sense, is abridged in many ways. But your speaking, too, is controlled by rules of procedure. You may, of course, differ in opinion from what I am saying. To that freedom, there are no limits. But unless the chairman intervenes, You are not allowed to express that difference by open speech until I have finished my reading. In a word, both you and I are under control as to what we may say and when and how we may say it. Shall we say then that this conference, which studies the principles of free speech, is itself making exceptions to that principle? I do not think so. Speech, as a form of human action, is subject to regulation in exactly the same sense as is walking, or lighting a fire, or shooting a gun. To interpret the First Amendment as forbidding such regulation is to so misconceive its meaning as to reduce it to nonsense. The principle here at issue was effectively, though not very clearly, stated by Mr. Justice Holmes when in the Frohwick case he said, "The First Amendment, while prohibiting legislation against free speech as such, cannot have been, and obviously was not, intended to give immunity to every form of language." We venture to believe that neither Hamilton, nor Madison, nor any other competent person ever supposed that to make criminal the counseling of a murder would be an unconstitutional interference with free speech. These words of the great justice, by denying that the First Amendment intends to protect all forms of speech, seems to me to nullify completely the supposed evidence that the amendment is open to exceptions. They show conclusively the falsity of the exception theory, which has been used by the courts to give basis for the danger theory of legislative authority to abridge our political freedom. If then the danger theory is to stand, it must stand on its own feet. And those feet, if my earlier argument is valid, seem to be made of clay. Mr. Chairman, in the first section of this paper, I spoke of the negative fact that the First Amendment forbids the legislature to limit the political freedom of the people. May I now, surveying the same ground from its positive side, discuss with you the active powers and responsibilities of free citizens as these are described or taken for granted in the general structure of the Constitution as a whole. We shall find here the reason why the words of the great proclamation are so absolute, so uncompromising, so resistant of modification or exception. The purpose of the Constitution is, as we all know, to define and allocate powers for the governing of the nation. To that end, three separate governing agencies are set up, and to each of them are delegated such specific powers as are needed for doing its part of the work. Now, that program rests upon a clear distinction between the political body which delegates powers and the political bodies, legislative, executive, and judicial, to which powers are delegated. It presupposes, on the one hand, a supreme governing agency to which originally all authority belongs. It specifies, on the other hand, subordinate agencies to which partial delegations of authority are made. What then is the working relation between the supreme agency and its subordinates? Only as we answer that question shall we find the positive meaning of the First Amendment. First of all, then, what is the supreme governing agency of this nation? In its opening statement, the Constitution answers that question. "We, the people of the United States," it declares, "do ordain and establish this Constitution." Those are the revolutionary words which define the freedom which is guaranteed by the First Amendment. They mark off our government from every form of despotic polity. The legal powers of the people of the United States are not granted to them by someone else, by kings or barons or priests, by legislators or executives or judges. All political authority, whether delegated or not, belongs constitutionally to us. If anyone else has political authority, we are lending it to him. We, the people, are supreme in our own right. We are governed, directly or indirectly, only by ourselves. But now, what have we, the people, done with the powers which thus inhere in us? Some of them we have delegated, but there is one power at least which we have not delegated, which we have kept in our own hands for our own direct exercise. Article 1, Section 2 authorizes the people in their capacity as electors to choose their representatives. And that means that we, the people, in a vital sense, do actively govern those who by other delegated powers govern us. In the midst of all our assigning of powers to legislative, executive, and judicial bodies, we have jealously kept for ourselves the most fundamental of all powers. It is the power of voting, of choosing by joint action those representatives to whom certain of our powers are entrusted. In the view of the Constitution, then, we the people are not only the supreme agency, we are also politically an active electorate, a fourth, or perhaps better, a first branch, which, through its reserve power, governs at the polls. It follows then from what has just been said that under the Constitution, we Americans are politically free only insofar as our voting is free. But to get the full meaning of that statement, we must examine more closely what men are doing when they vote and how they do it. The most obvious feature of activity at the polls is the choosing among candidates for office. But under our election procedures, with their party platforms and public meetings, with the turmoil and passion of partisan debate, the voters are also considering and deciding about issues of public policy. They are thinking. As we vote, we do more than elect men to represent us. We also judge the wisdom or folly of suggested measures. We plan for the welfare of the nation. Now it is these judging activities of the governing people which the First Amendment protects by its guarantee of freedom from legislative interference. Because we the people have work to do for the general welfare, we make two demands. First, our judging of public issues, whether done separately or in groups, must be free and independent, must be our own. It must be done by us and by no one else. And second, we must be equally free and independent in expressing at the polls the conclusions, the beliefs to which our judging has brought us. Censorship over our thinking, duress over our voting, are alike forbidden by the First Amendment. A legislative body or any other body which in any way practices such censorship or duress stands in contempt of the sovereign people of the United States. But further, still more specifically, What are the judging activities with which censorship and duress attempt to interfere? What are the intellectual processes by which free men govern a nation, and which therefore must be protected from any external interference? They seem to be of three kinds. First, as we try to make up our minds on issues which affect the general welfare, we commonly, though not commonly enough, read the printed records of the thinking and believing which other men have done in relation to those issues. Those records are found in books, ancient and modern, in magazines of facts and of opinion, in documents and newspapers, in works of art of many kinds. And all this vast array of idea and fact, of science and fiction, of poetry and prose, of belief and doubt, of appreciation and purpose, of information and argument, the voter may find ready to help him in making up his mind. Second, we electors do our thinking not only by individual reading and reflection, but also in the active associations of public or private discussion. We think together as well as apart. And in this field, we form parties, adopt platforms, conduct campaigns, hold meetings, in order that this or that set of ideas may prevail, in order that that measure or this may be defeated. And third, when election day finally comes, the voter, having presumably made up his mind, must now express it by his ballot. Behind the canvas curtain, alone and independent, he renders his decision. He acts as sovereign, one of the governors of his country. However slack may be our practice, that in theory is our freedom. What then is seen against this constitutional background is the purpose of the First Amendment as it stands guard over our freedom. That purpose is to see to it that in none of these three activities of judging shall the voter be robbed by action of other subordinate branches of the government of the responsibility, the power, the authority, which are his under the Constitution. What shall he read? What he himself decides to read. With whom shall he associate in political advocacy? With those with whom he chooses to associate. Whom shall he oppose? Those with whom he disagrees. Shall any branch of the government attempt to control his opinions or his vote, to drive him by duress or intimidation into believing or voting this way or that? To do so is to violate the Constitution at its very source. We, the people of the United States, are self-governing. That is what our freedom means. Mr. Chairman, this interpretation of the First Amendment, which I have tried to give, is of necessity very abstract. May I therefore give some more specific examples of its meaning at this point or that? First, in the field of public discussion, when citizens and their fellow thinkers peaceably assemble to listen to a speaker, whether he be American or foreign, conservative or radical, safe or dangerous, the First Amendment is not, in the first instance, concerned with the right of the speaker to say this or that. It is concerned with the authority of the hearers to meet together, to discuss and to hear discussed by speakers of their own choice, whatever they may deem worthy of their consideration. Second, the same freedom from attempts at duress is guaranteed to every citizen as he makes up his mind, chooses his party, and finally casts his vote. During that process, no governing body may use force upon him, may try to drive him or lure him toward this decision or that, or away from this decision or that. And for that reason, no subordinate agency of the government has authority to ask, under compulsion to answer, what a citizen's political commitments are. The question, are you a Republican? Or are you a communist? When accompanied by the threat of harmful or degrading consequences, if the answer is refused, or if the answer is this rather than that, is an intolerable invasion of the reserved powers of the governing people. And the freedom thus protected does not rest upon the Fifth Amendment right of one who is governed to avoid self-incrimination. It expresses the constitutional authority, the legal power of one who governs to make up his own mind without fear or favor, with the independence and freedom in which self-government consists. And third, for the same reason, our First Amendment freedom forbids that any citizen be required, under threat of penalty, to take an oath or make an affirmation as to beliefs which he holds or rejects. Every citizen, it is true, may be required and should be required to pledge loyalty and to practice loyalty to the nation. He must agree to support the Constitution, but he may never be required to believe in the Constitution. His loyalty may never be tested on grounds of adherence to or rejection of any belief. Loyalty does not imply conformity of opinion. Every citizen of the United States has constitutional authority to approve or to condemn any laws enacted by the legislature, any actions taken by the executive, any decisions rendered by the judiciary, any principles established by the Constitution. All these enactments, which as men who are governed we must obey, are subject to our approval or disapproval as we govern. With respect to all of them, we who are free men are sovereign. We are the people. We govern the United States. Mr. Chairman, I have tried to state and defend the assertion that the constitutional guarantee of political freedom is not open to exceptions. Judgment upon the theoretical validity of that position I now leave in your hands. But as between conflicting views of the First Amendment, there is also a practical question of procedural efficiency. May I, in closing, speaking with the tentativeness becoming to a non-lawyer, offer three suggestions as to the working basis on which decisions about political freedom should rest. First, the experience of the courts since 1919 seems to me to show that as a procedural device for distinguishing forms of speech and writing in the assembly which the amendment does protect from those which it does not protect, the clear and present danger test has failed to work. Its basic practical defect is that no one has been able to give it dependable or even assignable meaning. Case by case, opinion by opinion, it has shifted back and forth with a variability of meaning which reveals its complete lack of constitutional basis. In his opinion confirming the conviction of Eugene Dennis and others for violation of the Smith Act, Judge Leonard Hand reviewed the long series of judicial attempts to give to the words clear and present a usable meaning. His conclusion reads in part, the phrase clear and present danger is a way to describe a penumbra of occasions, even the outskirts of which are indefinable, but within which, as is so often the case, the courts must find their way as they can. In each case, they must ask whether the gravity of the evil, discounted by its improbability, justifies such an invasion of free speech as is necessary to avoid the danger. And to this bewildering interpretation of the words clear and present, he adds, that is a test in whose application the utmost differences of opinion have constantly arisen, even in the Supreme Court. Obviously, it would be impossible to draft a statute which would attempt to prescribe a rule for each occasion. And it follows, as we have said, either that the act is definite enough as it stands, or that it is practically impossible to deal with such conduct in general terms. Those words coming from the penetrating and powerful mind of Leonard Hand show how intolerable it is that the most precious, most fundamental value in the American plan of government should depend for its defense upon a phrase which not only has no warrant in the Constitution, but has no dependable meaning, either for a man accused of crime, or for the attorneys who prosecute or defend him, or for the courts which judge him. That phrase does not do its work. We need to make a fresh start in our interpreting of the words which protect our political freedom. Second, as we seek for a better test, it is of course true that no legal device can transform the making of decisions about freedom into a merely routine application of an abstract principle. Self-government is a complicated business. And yet the non-exception view which I have offered seems to me to promise a more stable and understandable basis for judicial decision than does the 1919 doctrine which the courts have been trying to follow. For example, the most troublesome issue which now confronts our courts and our people is that of the speech and writing and assembling of persons who find, or think they find, radical defects in our form of government, and who devise and advocate plans by means of which another form might be substituted for it. And the practical question is, how far and in what respects is such revolutionary planning and advocacy protected by the First Amendment? It is, I presume, understood that if such persons or groups proceed to forceful or violent action, or even to overt preparation for such action against the government, the First Amendment offers them in that respect no protection. Its interest is limited to the freedom of judgment-making, of inquiry and belief and conference and persuasion and planning and advocacy. It does not protect either overt action or incitement to such action. It is concerned only with those political activities by which, under the Constitution, free men govern themselves. From what has just been said, it follows that so far as speech and writing and assembly are concerned, the distinction upon which the application of the First Amendment rests is that between advocacy of action and incitement to action. To advocacy, the amendment guarantees freedom no matter what may be advocated. To incitement, on the other hand, the amendment guarantees nothing whatever. This distinction was sharply drawn by Mr. Justice Brandeis when, in the Whitney case, he said, "Every denunciation of existing law tends in some measure to increase the probability that there will be violations of it. Condemnation of a breach enhances the probability. Expressions of approval add to the probability. Propagation of the criminal state of mind by teaching syndicalism increases it. Advocacy of lawbreaking heightens it still further. But even advocacy of violation, however reprehensible morally, is not a justification for denying free speech where the advocacy falls short of incitement. And there is nothing to indicate that the advocacy would be immediately acted on." Those words, I think, point the way which decisions about our political freedom can and should follow. An incitement, I take it, is an utterance so related to a specific overt act that it may be regarded and treated as a part of the doing of the act itself, if the act is done. Its control, therefore, falls within the jurisdiction of the legislature. An advocacy, on the other hand, even up to the limit of arguing and planning for the violent overthrow of the existing form of government, is one of those opinion-making, judgment-making expressions which free men need to utter and to hear as citizens responsible for the governing of the nation. If men are not free to ask and to answer the question, shall the present form of our government be maintained or shall it be changed? If when that question is asked, the two sides of the issue are not equally open for consideration, for advocacy, for adoption, then it is impossible to speak of our government as established by the free choice of a self-governing people. It is not enough to say that the people of the United States were free 170 years ago. The First Amendment requires, simply and without equivocation, that they be free now. Third, and finally, if we say, as this paper has urged, that in many situations, speech and writing and assembly may be controlled by legislative action, we must also say that such control may never be based on the ground of disapproval of opinions held or expressed. No belief or advocacy may be denied freedom if in the same situation opposing beliefs or advocacies on the same issues are granted that freedom. If then, on any occasion in the United States, it is allowable to say that the Constitution is a good document, it is equally allowable in that situation to say that the Constitution is a bad document. If a public building may be used in which to say, in time of war, that the war is justified, then the same building may be used in which to say that it is not justified. If it may be publicly argued that conscription for armed service is moral and necessary, it may likewise be publicly argued that it is immoral and unnecessary. If it may be said that American political institutions are superior to those of England or Russia or Germany, it may with equal freedom be said that those of England, or Russia, or Germany, are superior to ours. These conflicting views may be expressed, must be expressed, not because they are valid, but because they are relevant. If they are responsibly entertained by anyone, we, the voters, need to hear them. When a question of policy is before the House, free men choose to meet it, not with their eyes shut, but with their eyes open. To be afraid of ideas, of any idea, is to be unfit for self-government. Any such suppression of ideas about the common good, the First Amendment condemns with its absolute disapproval. The freedom of ideas shall not be abridged.
The foregoing talk on the First Amendment, the Court of Our Constitution, was recorded by Alexander Micklejohn and presented as testimony before the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights. This is KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley. We present...
And when I ask a question, what's going on? I think you had... And I just try to cover this so they don't watch the sun.
What's the career then?
Well, that's, you can't make a mistake and wipe off. Now you see, when you're talking there, now it's about right. See, when I talk, halfway.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a little bit high. You don't even have to, it ought to be just a little bit lower than halfway, because it's too much. Mm-hmm. I had it fixed and you didn't. Then you have balanced tone and high. For ordinary speaking, it goes about there.
Mm-hmm.